Hello again, and welcome back to the ESVS podcasts. For the next couple of weeks, we are going back to basics with a series of podcasts entitled Vascular Fundamentals. My name is Justin Woolgar.
And I am Joanna Hallmann. In the first episode of this series, we are going to dig into hemodynamics. So, whether you are new to vascular surgery or a leading expert, we hope that this will be a start of a voyage of discovery or simply some useful revision. Without further ado, let's get into it. I guess the first question we should ask is what actually is the study of hemodynamics and what role does it play in vascular surgery?
Well, hemodynamics is essentially the study of how blood flows within the body, particularly in the arterial and venous systems. In this episode, we will predominantly concentrate on arterial hemodynamics. A grasp of the fundamental hemodynamic principles that occur, for instance, in arterial obstruction will hopefully give the listener a better understanding of the underlying pathophysiology. To start with, let's talk about the relationship between pressure, blood flow, and peripheral resistance.
Okay, first, what actually is the pressure in this context?
Pressure is often regarded as the force necessary for moving the blood. This force not only is made up of the pumping action of the heart, but also other sources of energy, such as potential energy and kinetic energy of the blood itself. Blood moves from point A to point B in response to differences in fluid energy. This brings us neatly on to the Bernoulli principle, which essentially states that when fluid flows steadily from A to B, its total energy content along any given streamline remains constant provided there are no frictional losses. This principle is a conservation of energy type equation and explains some weird paradoxes in fluid mechanics. For instance, let's say the pressure in your aorta is 120 millimeters of mercury. But when you measure the pressure at your ankles when standing up, the pressure often measures somewhere in the region of 160 to 170 millimeters of mercury, does it not? Traditionally, we think of fluids moving from a point of high pressure to low pressure, but clearly in this situation, it's totally the opposite. The reason for this apparent paradox is that fluid energy is being converted from one form to another. In the aorta, the blood has potential energy in addition to kinetic energy. Effectively, an increase in pressure results because of the combination of potential and kinetic energy being interchanged.
But Bernoulli's principle works for an ideal system with no friction. That's clearly not the case in the human circulation system.
Ah, you are quite correct. Another principle of fluid dynamics which we must mention is Poiseuille's law, which describes the pressure drop due to the viscosity of the fluid. This is something we have to be aware of because in the human circulation, energy losses are related to the viscosity of blood and its inertia. Viscosity is defined as the friction existing between continuous layers of fluid, which in an ideal situation causes the concentric layers of fluid to adopt a parabolic profile. The fluid in the center is traveling faster than at the edges, all in a nice, even, and so-called laminar flow. Without getting involved in the mathematics, the drop in energy is proportional to 8 times the length, the coefficient of viscosity, and inversely proportional to the 4th power of the radius. Sounds quite complicated. What this means in practice is that as the diameter is reduced, there is a point where the pressure gradient of a conduit drops off dramatically. Improving the overall flow might improve things slightly, but nowhere near as much as increasing the vessel diameter, thus decreasing the radius of the stenosis.
You mentioned inertia as a potential source of energy loss. How does it fit in?
Yes, indeed. Inertial losses are related to the density of the blood and the square of the velocity. You could think of it as the momentum of the blood. This means that if there is a sudden change in velocity, for instance at a major branch or narrowing, this will lead to a loss of potential energy within the system. Similar inertial losses are seen when there is a sudden change in the direction of the conduit. That is why it is important when you tunnel your bypass graft to make sure it is nice and linear with no right angles in it. Makes sort of sense, really.
Are there any other sources of energy losses in the circulation system?
Indeed, there are. We ought to mention turbulence. I'm sure you've all experienced turbulence in an aircraft where you get thrown about the cabin as a result of gusts of wind buffeting the aircraft. Same phenomena occurs in the circulation. Turbulent flow occurs when there are random velocities and directions in the fluid layers, which can cause energy losses. We have to mention something called the Reynolds number, which defines the property of a fluid which causes its flow to degenerate from laminar to turbulent. The Reynolds number is dependent on fluid density, viscosity, velocity, and the diameter of the conduit. So any of these factors can increase the risk of turbulent flow. For instance, any condition that alters the viscosity of the blood, say for instance anemia, will result in an increase in the Reynolds number and could potentially cause turbulent flow.
Okay, we've touched on pressure and flow. What about resistance?
Well, as you would imagine, in vascular surgery, resistance is very important in understanding the physiology of occlusive disease. The easiest way to get your head around flow resistance is to use the analogy of resistance in an electrical circuit. To demonstrate this, I will now conduct a quick experiment. One moment, please. For this experiment, I will now show you how resistance in a fluid model compares to an electrical circuit. I just so happen to have a 24 volt PC fan, and I have connected this in series with a rather large ceramic 20 ohm resistor. And the purpose of that is to drop the voltage to a measly 12 to 13 volts. So I'm going to turn on the power supply and hopefully this fan will spring into action. So the fan is chugging along quite nicely at half its rated voltage. So let's see what happens if we short the resistor out. So as you can see, the fan is really blowing very hard and is about to take off. The resistor is back in series. And again, I've shorted it out of circuit. Let's just turn this off. This is Ohm's law in action, V equals IR. Voltage equals the current times the resistance. In a fluid system, the resistance is the ratio of the pressure change, or equivalent to voltage, divided by the flow, or current, in our electrical system. Anyway, let me pack all this stuff away and get back to the podcast. This is a somewhat oversimplified analogy, as unlike electrical resistances, which are fairly fixed in value, hemodynamic resistances vary and are dependent on multiple factors. We have previously talked about the energy losses related to acceleration, inertia, and turbulence, all of which tend to result in an increase in resistance in a given vascular segment, especially as flow is increased for a given vessel diameter.
Okay, so we've talked about pressure, flow, and resistance. What I would like to know is how and when a narrowing or stenosis in an artery becomes significant stenosis. Why is it always greater than 70% and not, say, 40 or 65 or some other magic number?
That's a very good question. If you measure this experimentally by plotting out percentage of stenosis against percentage of maximum flow in an arterial model, you will find that appreciable changes in pressure and flow do not occur until the cross-sectional area of the vessel has been reduced by 75%. That usually corresponds to an axial symmetrical reduction in diameter of about 50%. It is important not to get the two confused. We know from Poiseuille's law that energy losses associated with arterial lesions are inversely proportional to the fourth power of the radius of the stenosis and to the fourth power of the ratio of the radius of the stenosis to that of the non-stenotic segment. Bit of a mouthful, really. Because these are exponential functions, the graphs plotting flow rates against degrees of stenosis tend to be sigmoid in appearance. Hence, the flow rates rapidly fall off once a certain critical narrowing is reached. We also know that energy losses across stenotic segments also depend on the velocity of blood flow, and that in turn is affected by the resistance in the system. High resistances tend to shift the graphs to the right, so that a higher degree of stenosis is required for it to become critical. On this basis, we can assume that vascular beds with low or high resistances will have slightly different values for when a stenosis becomes critical. Vascular beds with low resistances, such as the coronary, renal, or the carotid circulation, may reach criticality at a lower percentage narrowing than those with higher intrinsic resistances, such as the lower limb. Exercise will also tend to reduce resistance and can cause a non-critical stenosis to become critical. A good example of this in practice is the well-known fact that an iliac lesion may cause significant claudication symptoms on exercise, but at rest may be asymptomatic and visually may not be that particularly impressive.
So now we have an idea of what defines a critical stenosis. What about the length of the stenosis, or when there are several in a series?
Very often, for instance, when performing an SFA angioplasty, you may be faced with multiple stenoses along the length of the vessel. And the question often arises as to which one to treat in order to obtain maximum patient benefit. If you remember Poiseuille's law, the energy losses are proportional to 8 multiplied by the length of the narrowing, whereas radius is elevated to the fourth power. Doubling the length of a stenosis would merely double the viscous energy losses, but reducing the radius of the vessel lumen by half would increase the losses by a factor of 16. From this, we can deduce that doubling the length of the stenosis without changing its diameter would not double its resistance, whereas 2 separate lesions of the same size and diameter restriction are approximately equal to the sum of the 2 separate lesions. This is important when we return to our SFA angioplasty, as if there are multiple non-critical stenoses in series, added together, they may act as a single critical stenosis, something we often see with very diseased superficial femoral arteries. Treating a diseased vessel with, let's say, 2 stenotic lesions of similar caliber will only improve the blood flow by a small amount if you decided to just treat one of the lesions. It is also worth bearing in mind that if you are in a situation where there are 2 stenoses of unequal diameter, rather treat the lesion that is more severe, as this will significantly improve the flow, as opposed to just treating the less severe stenosis. This kind of sounds like common sense, but you'll be surprised that mistakes are not infrequently made. Great. Let's sum up the concepts we have covered in today's episode. Pressure with the Bernoulli principle, potential and kinetic energy, viscosity and Poiseuille's law, blood density and inertia, turbulence and the Reynolds number, and finally, peripheral resistance. Quite a lot to keep in mind, but I'm sure you'll have no problem.
For now, that wraps up the first in our series on arterial hemodynamics. In the next episode, we will continue to dig into arterial hemodynamics in specific situations in vascular surgery, such as claudication, limb ischemia, vascular grafts, and aortic aneurysms. Don't miss it. Keep tuned. Bye for now.
Remember, all ESVS podcasts are available in Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and the ESVS library. Bye-bye.